Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast. Before we get to my guest, who's really got an amazing story, I was thinking about a couple of things, so I just wanted to get him out there. I was thinking about the Last Supper. It had to be tense. You know, you're sitting around, you're breaking bread with Jesus. You know what's going to happen in a little bit, but what do you chit-chat? You make small talk? Like, oh, this is some hummus, Jesus. Like what's those are great sandals. If Orion and I were at the table, I'd be complaining. You know, like, fish and bread again? Come on, we get it, Jesus. You know, mix it up a little bit. Do you pay? I wonder who paid? You let Jesus pay. He's the boss. He can pick up the check. You know, besides, you're never going to see him again. Aha, then like 3 days later after the resurrection, you run into him on the street, and you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, I wanted to pay. I think that's where the phrase Jesus Christ came from. Anyway, I broke my pinky toe. I stubbed it. You know, there are three bones in the pinky toe, and I broke the middle one, and I broke it parallel, not perpendicular, and there's really nothing you can do for it except tape it to the other toe next to it, and, you know, it's the summer, you're walking around with, you know, your bare feet or sandals, and so the only thing that's more painful than the broken toe is that I have to explain to everybody every single time, every person I see, oh, what happened to your toe? And I can't be like, yeah, something macho, like I saved a baby from an oncoming truck. No, I stubbed my toe on a coffee table. So that's more painful than the actual pain in the toe. So what I'm saying is don't stub your toe. And if you do, just wear socks and shoes for about a month and a half. My guest this week, Jay Williams. Three-time Duke All-American basketball player, NBA star for the Chicago Bulls. He's now an ESP analyst, who I'm sure you've seen. He's got a crazy story that terrible thing happened at the beginning of his very, very promising career that changed his life forever. This story's got highs, it's got lows, it's really, really an amazing story. It's probably the most amazing story I've heard on my podcast. And he's a really great guy. So enjoy that. And thanks for checking out the podcast. Please tell your friends about it. Send the links around. We want to keep building our following. So please, please, if you can do that this week, that would be awesome. And I'm giving you a nice variety of guests. I hope you enjoy it. And please leave a comment on iTunes if you haven't. That always helps. Only if it's nice. If it's negative, then keep it to yourself. And if you have any thoughts, things you want me to talk about, or things that are bothering you, tweet me, at Paul Mercurio, M-E-C-U-R-I-O, at Paul Mercurio, anything you want. You want me to talk about something? You want to complain about something? I won't mention your name if you don't want to. You want to give me some healing remedies for my broken toe? Whatever. All right. Enjoy Jay Williams. So, life good?
Running around? Life is fascinating right now, which is really fucking cool.
Yeah.
Considering life may not have been anything about, you know, 14 years ago.
Yeah, well, are we rolling? Yeah, all right, good. Say whatever you want to say. Talk about whatever we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about your book. I am here with my buddy Jay Williams, who is currently an analyst on ESPN, but a three-time Duke All-American, number two pick in the NBA draft, played for the Chicago Bulls, then did something stupid and fucked up his career, but is back now and has been back. And you call it stupid, I don't. But welcome to the show. Great to have you.
It's good to be here, man.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
And you got a great book out, and it's called Life is Not an Accident, A Memoir of Reinvention. And we kind of know each other a little bit because we did a panel like for a show at ESPN. Mm-hmm. A while back. I thought that was a good
way
show.
Way back in the day.
Room for debate.
Yeah, that was a good show too. I'm mad it never actually came to fruition.
Yeah, I know. But you've been great on ESPN. You really sort of have a very analytical mind. Clearly you played the game, but like have a way to explain things without sort of talking down to the viewer. And I don't know if that's conscious or not, but you're really good at that.
Well, first off, what makes me different than anybody else? Nothing.
Yeah.
I just happen to be good at a sport the same way somebody could be, you know, happen to be great at math or happen to be great at politics. Actually, I don't know if that can really exist. but, you know, for me, it's funny. I think for a long time. I don't even look at basketball from an analytical perspective as far as like a coach's X's and O's.
Right.
I more look at the person and the psyche that the person has, the mentality. If the person, you know, looks like a society would say, quote unquote, is he weak or is he strong? You know, and I think I try to break down sports more so from that mental angle or perspective.
Which you did as a player.
Yeah, because I still do it to this day to a certain degree. I think I size people up pretty quickly.
Do players have tells? In other words, like when you're playing defense on somebody, I mean, you're going to watch film on somebody. We'll get to the book too.
Of course.
But like you break somebody down and then you start to kind of analyze them. Do they have tells like, okay, he's going to go left, he's going to go right, he's got a certain move he likes to do when he does this with his foot or something like that?
Oh, big time. I think that's the analytical part of basketball, which is, it's any sport though.
Yeah.
Right? And here's the beautiful part about where we are now. We're so sophisticated technology-wise that you see the next level of trash talking. So, you know, prime example, you know, when you're playing somebody back in the day, I'm not going to say who the player was, but I'm sitting down with him and his team, and they're going through scouting report on an NBA level.
Yeah.
And you start to recognize the guy he was guarding when he comes off a ball screen with the ball in his left hand. You know, he's going to usually shoot a pull-up jumper 9 out of 10 times instead of going to the basket.
Wow.
Because he only finishes at the basket 10% of the time with the finish rate with his left hand. So imagine the next level of trash talking where I say, hey, he's going to come off, he has to shoot because he can't get to the rim. So subconsciously, when you're saying that to me, what does it force you to do? Oh, this guy's a jerk. I can get my ass to the rim if I really want to, which you know he's not going to finish a good percentage around.
So you force him into the weaker part of his game.
Yeah, it's I call it mental Jedi mind tricks. And they're being played 24/7 all day, every day.
Oh my God. And do you, when you're guarding somebody, are you watching their feet or their hips? Like what is your focus on the defensive side of the ball?
You mean if I'm like just, well, it depends. What am I just physically trying to stop you, or am I mentally trying to toy with you?
Well,
because they're almost two different things.
Well, I want to hear both. Let's just start with the physical. Just physically, you're trying to stop me. I'm at the top of the key with a ball. I'm dribbling,
trying to move.
Decide, you know, screens are happening. Okay, all of that. Where are your eyes on the body in terms of? Because you know, guys like I'm a Celtics fan. I grew up in New England.
Okay, you're moving on up. Congratulations on your team. Danny Ainge is doing a hell of a job.
Yeah, no, man. You listen to radio up there. They're really tough in that market on all the sports.
Tell
and they basically
it.
Have been like, you know, he better do something with these picks. He's got all these assets. If he didn't get Gordon Hayward, he would have been strung up.
Well, we ain't got the Patriots winning Super Bowl after Super Bowl.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, the bar is set kind of high.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Red Sox three. Growing up, we didn't have any of that. It was like, you know, Steve Grogan for the Patriots, and the Red Sox never won. They came close. The Celtics were good. Then we had Lenny Bias dies, mm-hmm. who's going to be that next
the
bridge
wave.
To the
yep.
next thing. And but what are you doing? What do you the moves that these guys have? Like an Avery Bradley, a great defender. Like how do you lock down a guy who's got 48 moves in 3 seconds?
It's easy. It goes back to the basic fundamental principles of defense.
Mm.
I don't pay attention to your eyes. I don't pay attention to your shoulders because it can hurt and jerk and shake. I don't pay attention to your hands because some of the speeds that athletes have now are just sick.
Yeah.
I pay attention to your core, your belly button. You cannot go anywhere without your belly button.
Yeah.
So you can give me all this up top. But that can't go anywhere unless your belly button moves.
So the minute that's moving. Like,
exactly. Yeah. So the more I can be fixated on your middle torso, which could give off the wrong impression if somebody were to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Because you're staring at a sensitive area. Okay. Like that's where I would focus on.
I think Jay likes that guy. What's going on?
He keeps staring at his middle pocket area. Not sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's where I think you hear some of the best defenders ever to play in the game. If that's a Scottie Pippen in that category, he always talked about just focusing right there on that point.
Poor.
Because, you know, he can always cut you off. And then it's about the next level mentally, too, understanding what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are.
Yeah, talk about that. I'm fascinated by that.
Well, that's the mental side of anything. It's the same thing they teach you when you're going through, you know, learning how to debate somebody.
Right.
You know, people have pressure points.
Right.
And then usually when you put somebody in an uncomfortable position, a lot of people aren't comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yes.
So if I know that, hey, just because you're a pro doesn't mean that you've excelled in every category of the particular sport.
Mm-hmm.
So that prime example that I gave off the top about forcing you to do little things that I know the percentages are in my favor.
Yeah.
That's what I want to try to get you to do more and more.
Yeah.
And there's some people who are so damn competitive, they can't help themselves.
Yeah.
They get in their own way.
Yeah.
You know, which is fascinating to watch as well.
Well, Isaiah Thomas on the Celtics
you know, gave props to Kobe, who worked with him on breaking down film. And mm-hmm. Isaiah said that was a big, one of the big parts of his game going to another level last year, was that he really, for the first time, like, looked at film and really made it a priority. And he said it was a big difference.
I'll tell you, Paul, the best players or best people successful at anything I've ever seen are psychotic.
Yeah. In terms of research, preparation.
Yeah. Obsessive compulsive. Yeah. Thing where yeah. it's like they study their craft to a certain extent that yeah. just blows you away.
Yeah.
I actually sat in a meeting with Kobe at the Players Tribune, and usually when I'm in a room of athletes, I can steer a conversation just because I've been forced for the past 14 years of my life to see who the hell Jay Williams is without this sport, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're an athlete, you don't have time to really think about that. Not saying that you don't want to, but you're so, you know, you have the horse blinders on. You have to focus on what you have to focus
right,
on.
Right.
So I'm used to steering conversations. And yeah. when I'm in that room, I think one of the only people I've ever deferred to is probably Kobe Bryant.
Really?
Just because he asks very intuitive questions that I don't think regular athletes would ask.
So give us context. What was this gathering you were in, and he was asking questions? Why was he asking questions? Was it just a discussion among
it was. Peers? So, I mean, we're in a room where it's, you know, Kobe Bryant, Blake Griffin, Kevin Durant, Maria Sharapova, Julian Thomas.
Wow.
We had some big-time athletes in yeah. the room. Derek Jeter was there. And it was all about, hey, how do we help athletes start to curate their own content? How do we help them storytell? Because that's where we're moving to within the media
realm. Are you talking about what is the second act of their life after sports?
No.
Or while they're, what is their brand, define their brand, and beyond sort of getting a sneaker deal?
Definitely
and
the
being
latter.
In a commercial. Okay.
So, I mean, let's be realistic, right? And I know we put a lot of effort, and this is not to demean what athletes go through.
Right.
But if I wake up every morning, I train at 6:30, and I get done training around 8:30, maybe I come back and I have breakfast, and then maybe I have another training for another 2-3 hours a day. Okay, that's 5 hours.
Right.
I have 19 hours left in my day.
Right.
If I sleep 8 hours, I have 11 hours left in my day.
Right.
What are you doing to perpetuate your brand
right.
and your own narrative?
Right.
So, you know, there are all these little things that we all like to do naturally. So how are you building a business off of that? So just being able to...
So in other words, tap into what makes Jay Jay, what makes Kobe Kobe, what makes Sharapova Sharapova, and build on that, and that's
exactly.
that's the nub of it that you want. That's the nut that you start with.
But it starts off with asking yourself one of these questions, because a lot of these people are introverted. Because they
yeah.
usually when you say something, if you don't want to lose an endorsement, you have to be politically correct.
Right.
So, you know, it's funny. We want these athletes to show us who they really are,
right.
but then we debase them or we yell at them or we become angry when they
right.
do become opinionated.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a way you have to force yourself not to give a shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Say, this is who I am.
Right.
I don't care what you think.
Right.
I may lose an endorsement because I feel this way.
Right.
Or I have to run through my team.
Right.
But Kobe asked a question, which it was really garnered great responses. What is your biggest fear as an athlete? And like for the first 10 minutes, people didn't know how to answer the question.
What did some of them say?
Julian Thomas stepped up and it was really inspiring. He said, I don't know if I understand who I am without the sport that I played.
Wow.
For so long, it's identified myself. And I yeah. sat there in my own mind, and I kind of laugh at that because, you know, whenever you get introduced, it's funny, as a society, we have to categorize somebody.
Right.
We have to give, you know, we have to give some kind
label.
Of...
label.
Exactly. You know, hey, this is where this person came from, or this is what this person accomplished.
Yeah. I mean, just the way I introduced
context.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
The NBA, you know, to All-American, yeah.
So I haven't played professional basketball since I was 21 years old.
Right.
That was 14 years ago.
People, right.
Hey, Jay Williams, professional basketball player. I'm like, well, I don't even know if I'm in that box.
Right.
I can barely move
right.
on the court.
Right. But you faced that issue with this injury that was career-ending. It's like... But in a blink of an eye, you had to go, okay, who am I? Where do I go next? What do I do after your whole life has been basketball? And so Julian was asking that same question.
And he's been doing his sport for, you know, 14, 15
yeah.
years. I can't imagine how difficult that is to do. And that's why we're trying to tell these guys as they're younger, start branching out. Start doing other things, right? So you can have more sustainability throughout the course of your life if you retire by the time you're 33.
Sort of like what Kobe had been doing the last few years before he retired. It seemed like he was more out there with his other aspects of his life and business. But talk about a guy that's completely defined by his career, Kobe. Did he lob in an answer for that, or did he respond to that?
He did not, which made me think about an opportunity. I can't wait to sit down with Kobe and kind of ask him these same questions that he's asking other people.
Yeah.
And I think we all try to do this to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Anybody that tells you they have it all figured out, they're damn liars.
No, I mean, I'm a comedian, but I was a lawyer and an investment banker on Wall Street.
And how the hell did you go from an investment banker and a lawyer on Wall Street to becoming a comedian?
I just wanted to meet Jay Williams. I said, this is the path. I got to do this.
I love when you lie to me. Yeah. It's like that line. That's great.
No, I think it was just something happened. The spark went off. I was writing jokes as a hobby, and I met Jay Leno, and I wrote, gave him hand in my jokes, and I said, I'm never going to use these. You can take them.
How the hell did you get the balls just to walk up to Jay Leno and say, hey, here are my jokes if you want to use them?
I don't know. I did the same thing with Paul McCartney. That's how I got him on my podcast. He was at the Colbert Report. I was working there at the time, and he was in the hallway, and I'm approaching the hallway. I round the corner, and there, standing against the wall, all alone, like literally his arms folded like he was waiting for a bus, looking up at the ceiling, chewing gum, is Paul McCartney. And my whole world slows down. I'm like, holy my God, it's Paul McCartney. And I'm like, do I say hi? Do I not say hi?
Yes.
You know, in the business that we're in, there's a sort of unwritten rule. Like, you leave big stars alone, you know, for the most part, and they, you know. But I'm like, I'm never going to meet this guy again. Fuck it. I'm just going to go, just as my, on my way by, I'm just going to say hello. And I say hello. And he goes, wait, come back. What do you do? I go, I'm a stand-up. He goes, oh, yeah, I love stand-up. You got a kid? Yeah, I got a kid. We start talking like 10 or 15 minutes ago, I'm talking to Paul McCartney. Anyway, I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, first of all, on the outside, I'm like, hey, I'm talking to Paul McCartney. On the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney.
Exactly, like a little kid.
Long story short, I go to the bathroom. I call my wife. I'm hyperventilating. I'm like, I talk to Paul McCartney. And then I hang up the phone and I go, Paul McCartney should do my podcast. Like, that's what I think. Because I'm fascinated by process, as you could probably tell from some of the questions. Regardless of what somebody does, particularly musicians, that they have the ability to hear all of those sounds and lyrics and put them all together. So I went, I knocked on the door, and I said, I know this is crazy, but I would love to talk to you about the process of writing music. Would you do my podcast? And he goes, yeah, sure.
That's awesome. And then you know what's amazing about that, though? Like, it's funny how life sometimes puts things in your way. Before I came here, I had another meeting that got canceled. So I'm sitting at the Starbucks right across the street.
Okay? Yeah.
I'm just reading the New York Times, having a refresher, waiting for my friend Dre to get there.
Yeah.
And this guy knocks on a window, and this guy, Kevin, I haven't seen him for a while. I'm like, hey, what's up? And he's like, yo, what's up? And he kind of passed by, and I was like, it's cool. That's typical New York.
Yeah.
You run into people. That's the end of it, right?
Right.
I go back down to read my newspaper.
Did you know the guy?
I knew him from a while back but I also didn't. I didn't recognize, like, hey, like, how I knew the guy.
Right.
I just knew I knew his face.
You knew him, yeah.
And he walks back in, and he's like, hey, yo, Tracy Morgan wants to see you. Come on. I'm like, what? I haven't seen Tracy Morgan since I was 24 years old, and I was in a bad space living in North Carolina. I was waiting to walk inside a club, and my boy Graham and I were in this, you know, line together, and this guy started to talk to me. This guy had this really weird voice, and I was a little bit drunk at the time, and I was on Oxycontin because I was just trying to come back from my accident. And Graham's like, yo, you know that's Tracy Morgan. We hung out with him all night long.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine. He's a great guy.
He's
crazy.
Incredible.
He's crazy
too.
But he's not crazy.
Agreed.
Like, he's got an act. He's shrewd. You don't be 20 years in this business, at least at that level of success, without being, but funny bastard, man.
Oh, funny as hell. So next thing I know, I'm riding Tracy's, you know, trailer, and I'm watching one of his first episodes of The Lasso of G, this whole new series he's coming out with. Just now. That just happened now.
Where's his trailer?
It's right across the street.
What's he?
It's literally right across the street, right next to the Starbucks.
That's
hilarious.
And
I'm just sitting here, I'm like, how funny is that? You know, in my mind, I'm like, do you ask Tracy for a picture? Tracy would probably allow me to take a picture. No, I don't ask Tracy for a picture. Don't be that guy right now.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's amazing how many times when you just treat people like they're regular
people. That's exactly what somebody said to me. If I had asked McCartney for an autograph or a picture, none of that would have happened. And I didn't, because I'm like, this poor guy, he's 72 at the time. He's got 50 years of people up his ass. So I literally was talking to him just like a guy, an average guy who, you know, eats, breathes, shits, has a family, has issues, whatever. And we're just talking, just shooting the shit. And people would walk by looking at me like, well, Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney knows Paul McCartney. I'm like, all right, right. But yeah, I think you have to do that. I tell my son that. You never know. You got nothing to lose. You know what I mean? As long as you do it properly. But like, I want to talk about get more into your story, because it's it's a sad story, but there's redemption, and it's
I think
great.
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
I don't associate
and,
any and negative
for, and for people who don't know, and I didn't know this at the time when we did the show together, I knew you and knew of you, but you know, you were you had Michael Jordan's locker, for God's sake. You were a Bull.
I stole it.
Screw
you, MJ.
And you're a rookie.
I'm joking, Mike. I'm
yeah.
joking.
But. How you have a nice rookie season, good numbers. You're on a path, and then motorcycle accident changes everything. Give us a little snapshot of what happened and where you are, and then we'll talk about where you are now and all that.
Yeah, I guess the Cliff Note version is, you know, you wait your whole life to accomplish a goal that you've only dreamt of.
Right.
And, you know, when that goal is right there in arm's reach, hand's reach, I finally felt like I had started to figure out the process of how to be great within the confines of the NBA. Coming from Duke was a gift and a curse. It was a gift because I got a chance to play for a Hall of Fame coach.
Yeah.
That taught me about family. It taught me about an environment that's conducive to be better in the bigger game of life. It was the curse because when I got to the next level that I've always dreamt of getting to, that was recreational basketball. You know, playing for the Bulls was recreational basketball.
What do you mean by that?
Well, management was in disarray. You know, we had Jerry Krause, who obviously put Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan together, but we had the average age of our team was around 23. We didn't really have the same kind of leadership. Bill Cartwright was our head coach.
Wait. So you're saying that I thought you were going to say, like, going from Duke was like sort of the minor leagues and now you're in the big league. You're almost saying it was the reverse.
I went from the big leagues to the minor leagues.
Are you shitting me?
Yes. Yes.
That was how buttoned up Duke was. And I know under Coach K it is.
Well, not just buttoned up. I mean, everything from the way we traveled to, you know, if you're on my team and you fell down, there's no damn way I was going to allow another player from another team to extend you a hand to pick you up. I'm running over to pick you up.
Right.
We spent time together. There was trust involved. We did like trust exercises. Like, you really felt like you were coming from a family.
Yeah.
Like, there was nothing I wouldn't do for my teammates, even to this day.
So now you're in the Bull and you're saying recreational and that sort of.
Well, see, my first game, our captain threw me under the bus. Like, our first game, we're playing against Boston. How fitting is this? And, the one thing I fucking sucked at was shooting free throws. Excuse my language.
I'm
sure there'll be a lot more F-bombs dropped on this podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to the free throw. I don't think I shot well from the free throw line that game, but I still, I think, ended up with 20-plus points and, you know, a great game. And we won the game.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you wake up the next morning and you read in the paper, and Jalen Rose is quoted by saying, I was a choke artist. You know, you're sitting there saying, damn, this is my teammate. This is our captain.
So now, is that some psychological thing which Bird would do with his players, like kind of kick him in the ass and get him going? Or was it just him being a dick?
Well, you know, if it was a psychological thing to get me motivated, I didn't see it in that light.
Yeah.
Because I came, once again, the gift. I come from an environment where
supported.
Nobody would ever say that.
Yeah.
Right? We won. First off, we lose the game.
Right.
Maybe. We won the damn game.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
and you had 20-plus points. Yeah.
Exactly. So why even go down that route? So you can only imagine the kind of, you know, how contentious it became. Like, you know, you walk in, you see that guy the next day, you're like, oh, okay, fuck you. Like, now I'm not going
to. So what did you do? Did you talk to him about it?
No. Well, I come from a background where my mom and dad kind of fought growing up.
Yeah.
So there's this hesitation for me to engage people in difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And that just becomes elevated even more so when you have money, right? Because now I don't need to.
Yeah.
To a certain degree.
And you're not mature enough to know, and neither is he, and I don't mean this as an insult, to know that in the bigger scheme of things and for the long run, it's better to clear the air because it's just going to be under there festering anyway.
Prime example, LeBron James and Kyrie Irving right now.
Right.
Right, Kobe, Shaquille O'Neal,
great analogy.
Like whatever it is,
Lennon, McCartney, like all of that.
All day long. We've seen it through the history of sports and entertainment.
Some of the parts is greater than the whole. Yeah.
Like if two people were just to have a beer, and I forget the damn commercial. It's all these commercials that are out there now. I think it was Miley Cyrus is like on stage, and you know, one of the people from the sound department is working with her on the microphone, and you know, he says to her directly, he's like, hey, your mic's probably going to cut out about 10 to 15 times a night. People are going to hate you and they're going to be annoyed and people are going to want their money back. And the whole, you know, impetus of the commercial is say really what's going on. Why don't people just like cut through all the bullshit? And actually,
oh, I've seen those. The right? woman comes over with a cake.
Exactly.
And she goes, hi, yeah. I'm having this cake. But and then she walks in and goes, oh, your house smells like onions. Like, exactly. Yeah, oh, yeah. Wouldn't it be great if people said what they really think?
Exactly, right? But we never do that. Right. So for me, I suppress that. I walk away. And that just that just builds throughout the course of time.
You think he was threatened by you?
I
mean, you're highly touted and you are proving yourself right away in the NBA.
I think that just stems to a bigger problem that we have within the black community sometimes. And I talk out about it. It's, hey, so I went to an educated school and I talk a certain way, which means I'm not black. I'm an Uncle Tom. And I think that's a major
issue. That's still
I think look, I'm from Plainfield, New Jersey, close to Newark. I still have some friends that look at things that way to a certain degree, or they consider you to be a sellout because hey, like, well, I don't associate education with being white. That's a major issue right off the bat.
Right.
You know, you can be educated and be black, and being black doesn't mean that you have to have your pants around your waist either.
Right.
Or talk a certain way. So how do we change that stereotype?
Yeah.
And I think coming into the league, Jalen made it known that, you know, he didn't really like Duke. I mean, he made it known in his documentary that he did about the Fab Five. So me coming in as a black kid, even though I came from a difficult area, you come from Duke, you know, you're labeled as a goody two-shoe boy. He didn't have to go through it like I had to go through.
So he's probably like, I'm going to test this goody two-shoes boy a little bit.
Exactly. So then they're into becoming factions on the team, which just think about how that cripples a unit.
Right.
You're no longer a unit.
Right.
You know, you have guys on the sideline.
And the coach management couldn't sort of get
it. Coach Bill Cartwright spoke like this, and it's not to say that he wasn't very informed with the way he coached, but you couldn't hear a damn word he said when there was 25,000 people in the gym. I can't hear you, Bill. And Paul, there was one moment that just really, that shit never would have happened at Duke. We're playing a game, I forget who we're playing against, and this is the league, right? And some people could look at this as a positive or a negative. Once again, it depends on where you come from.
Right.
So if I'm in the middle of a timeout and a Coach K is talking, you're damn right nobody's going to say a word.
Right.
Like, our head coach is talking. He's telling us a play.
Right.
We're in a timeout with Bill Cartwright, and I think I just scored like the last three or four possessions in the game, and we have a chance to win the game.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Cartwright is designing a play for me to take the shot. Myself, or I think it was myself, or like Tyson on a roll, pick and roll, whatever the scenario was. And I watched Jalen Rose. And it's not, Jalen's my boy now. We laugh at this kind of stuff because I think we've all matured, right?
Yeah.
Jalen knocked the clipboard out of his hand and said, no, you're running the damn play for me. And I watched Bill Cartwright
pause. Are you
shitting
me?
I watched Bill Cartwright pause as a 21-year-old kid. And I'm sitting like, uh-oh, Jalen's about to get cursed out. He's about to get told what the deal really is.
Yeah.
Tell him, Bill, tell him now. And Bill was like, All right, Jalen, we're going to run the play for you. And I said, oh, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
There's no way. And just watch them change the play. So
that's bad for the whole team to
see
that.
That gave you the foundation of who was running the team.
Right.
You know?
And so that was probably the biggest eye-opening experience coming into the NBA from Duke. Like, you thought this was going to be buttoned up to another level, and it's actually the reverse. And so now you're trying to make your mark and become the star that in your mind when you were 8 years old dreaming about this that you want to be. How do you start to navigate this world that's like upside down based on what you thought it was going to be?
Well, originally I tried to stay true to how I did things at Duke, but I found myself drifting off because
distractions hanging out, a lot of things.
Women were a distraction.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't get a chance to really party at Duke.
Yeah.
I lost 9 games in my 3 years. You know,
And now you don't have anybody to hold your hand, you slap you
not
down.
Not just
or
hold
whatever.
Your hand, but it's like you lose a game, and after the game is over, Paul, and people are checking their box scores. You know, like, I'm not used to that. Like, you lose a game at Duke, it's like somebody died.
Yeah.
You know, we're down by 25 points against, you know, Dallas Mavericks. And I'm trying to stop Steve Nash, and I come off the bench, and I have some guys on our basketball team that are sending ball boys over to girls who are in stands to try to get their number.
During
the game. You have some guys who are high during the game. I even started to smoke
high
later
in the game?
In season.
Yes. Right, I'm leaving.
Some guys play better high.
I'm going into the NBA.
Hey, but I'm going to give you a knock on it, though. I mean, you're playing high anyway if you take a Percocet before a game. I mean, I knew guys that had injuries that would try to play through injuries. What's the difference? There really is no difference.
Right.
Some guys play better that way, you know, but you don't understand it. And you take that as, oh, you're treating the game wrong.
Or,
you know, and just some guys approach the game differently. We all come from different backgrounds. So,
but then how does a star like a Kobe or a Shaq or a LeBron...
They become hated.
Or Bird, etc., Michael, MJ, how do they... tolerate that, or does that behavior get clamped down on by those stars on those teams?
Well, first off, when we're talking about the stars of the stars,
right?
Okay.
Right.
Secondly, you know, all these guys have stories where they were ultimately hated by a lot of people. You have to go through a lot of weeds before you start winning championships. And it's funny, we remember people for their greatness. You know, like we don't, you know, now our age is a little bit different where we're, you know, is LeBron James feared and the guy has like four championships. You're like, damn, we're still breaking down LeBron.
Right.
But there were a lot of people that didn't fuck with Kobe for a long time before Kobe started winning. Even when Kobe was winning with Shaq. Remember all that beef between Kobe and Shaq and how people were taking Shaq's side? And Kobe's, you know, never
so the
be
other
pleased.
Fellow players, just they thought he was not him in particular, I'm not singling him out, but some of these guys can create bad blood between them and their players because of their attitude and sort of the my shit doesn't smell kind of attitude and all of that.
Jordan wasn't a winner until he won his first one. I mean, people were asking to be traded. Like, there were, you know, stories of fights.
Because he was so difficult to be work with.
Yeah, I mean, or...
Was he too demanding? Was he justified or were they justified? Was he just too demanding and people just didn't want to deal with it? Yeah.
It was both.
Yeah, it's any relationship when it breaks down. It's both sides are kind of contribute to it.
Exactly. You know, and Jordan didn't want to trust people. It's the same kind of mentality that Kobe has to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You know, you're willing to make that pass to a Steve Kerr to take a game-winning shot.
Yeah.
When, you know, you don't believe in your other teammates' ability the same way you believe in yourself.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, Golden State now is an example of where they trust each other and it works. Of course, you've got another superstar you're passing the basketball to, so it's a little different.
I mean, but you almost in a way, I mean, KD is kind of blossoming from this, but you had beta superstars.
Yeah.
Like, the only real alpha I saw on that team was Draymond.
Yeah.
Like, ultimate alpha. KD's blossoming into that, but I mean, Steph Curry, he's not, I mean...
No.
He's a beta. I mean, Klay Thompson is kind of a beta. I mean, they're superior
and
betas.
I don't think KD, and there's nothing wrong with this, but I don't think he ever becomes a pure alpha a la LeBron or Kobe or Bird or Draymond, you know? And which always surprises me because no disrespect to Draymond, but he's an alpha in the category of the names I just said, but is not at their level of talent.
I agree. I think KD is slowly going in that direction, though. Like, if you pay attention to him and just his social media over the last couple of years, like, he says things to people now that you're like, oh, shit, KD.
Yeah.
Like, he'll just attack somebody. Like, he is playing like the villain.
Yeah.
Because that's how he wants to leave his legacy.
Yeah,
You know, people don't understand, like, when you attack somebody, you're attacking people's legacy. That's how they're looking at it.
Hey, let me ask you this as a player. We'll get to your book, more of the book, I promise.
That's all good.
But I could talk to you all day. I've always taken the side of the star, like a KD or LeBron, where they leave a city to go to another team, and the city burns their jersey, and the players, the citizens feel like, you know, that they've been disrespected, and it's like, this guy doesn't owe you anything. He came from most likely a poor background. He did his time in Oklahoma, right? Oklahoma City. Like, how do you players? I mean, obviously, you must feel the same way. Where did this sort of expectation come in that these players spend the rest of their career in a team where they can't win a championship when they've given it their all and they tried their best to make it work there?
I think it's a multitude of things. I think first off, it's asinine. You know, the fans shouldn't expect that much from the players, and neither should the players expect that much of the fans. Number two, I think that people buy into this politically correct BS that occurs.
Right.
You know, whenever there's any speculation, and that is a fault of players always trying to say the right thing. Right.
Elaborate on that a little
bit. You try to lessen distractions. So, prime example, if my contract is up with ESPN in 2 years,
right,
and somebody, hey, what's the future hold for you? Now, if I were to say at this given moment, well, you know, look, I really want to be on Showtime, and I think Showtime is the right place for me, and, you know, I want to be their first late night host and kind of do what Bill Simmons did at HBO, but actually do it better for Showtime.
Mm.
Boom, headlines.
Yeah.
Jay's not distracted. Jay doesn't want to be at ESPN. Yeah. Now, I might be telling the truth about what my overall long-term plan is, but now all of a sudden I'm being...
You box yourself.
Exactly, because I told the truth.
It's sort of like Kyrie saying 2 years left on his contract to trade me, right?
I mean, then you hate on him. Then it becomes a spectacle, right? Whereas if I say, hey, you know, look, I love ESPN. I want to be there for the rest of my career.
Right.
Blah, blah. Or I love Cleveland.
Saying is then at the end of the 2 years, you go to Showtime and ESPN's like the fans in Oklahoma City. Like, what the fuck? You said you were going to stay,
You said
man.
You love this. You said this is the place you're going to be for the next 25 years. You're an effing liar. I mean, so you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah.
So most guys end up not saying anything.
Yeah.
And that's why people don't want to be seen in the media or don't want to give their real opinions because they don't want to be chastised for it.
But also, citizens of a city should be adult enough to understand, look, I love sports
to
death.
Should be.
But nobody should be so passionate and pissed off that you go to the trouble of taking a jersey and burning it in public. Like, that's like, you know what I mean? Like, I understand your passion about your team, but like, those people... in fairness to the media, and the players who have to deal and be in the media, I have to put a lot of it on the fans who have unreasonable reactions and expectations of these people.
I agree. Well, number one, I'm not going to sit here and say that everybody's mature.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of immature people out there. Number two, I think it's also part of media. I think that we push or perpetuate these kind of things, i.e., LeVar Ball.
Yeah.
Right?
It's ratings.
You know, when you burn a jersey and you put it on, you know, social media or, you know, IG and it gets 10,000 likes, it perpetuates that type of behavior.
Right.
When we show it on ESPN, look, I'm on ESPN. I'm on SportsCenter.
Yeah.
I need to start doing more crazy things. So, you know, as a society, what kind of message are we sending? You know, we have a lot of attention grabbers right now.
Yeah.
And that's what we push because that's what gets views.
Yeah. So how did you make it through your rookie season in such a successful way, given how, you know, you had to, you're kind of, it's like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your stomach at the same time, and that, like, now you have to get your head around the world that you didn't expect to be the way it was going to be, and then play to a much higher level just athletically. Would you call Coach K for some just wisdom from time to time, or how did you get through the season?
Coach K came and saw a couple of my games. I think that my mentality started to change towards the end of the season, where I had to come back to a foundational level and say, these guys aren't my brothers. This is not where I played at last year. The expectations aren't that we're going to win 60 games. I can only have expectations on my own individual play. And it was a selfish approach, but it was the only approach I knew in order to help me stay above all the BS that was happening.
Right.
Because I wanted to be a leader.
Yeah.
I think I said some things throughout the course of the year that, you know, when you're not winning games, I kind of got beat up for.
Yeah.
But I wanted to overall change the perception of what we were trying to do on the court.
How long had Michael been gone at that point?
Well, Michael actually had came back and was playing for the Washington Wizards.
Oh, that was it, right. So the ghost of Michael was still very present
still
in
there.
The room.
I mean,
nobody was filling the void a la, you know, like, who's, like, right now they're talking about the Red Sox and Big Poppy's gone, and all the conversation is every day.
They played well last night.
Yeah, it's like, who's the leader in the clubhouse? Who's the leader? And then finally, a few days ago, Pedroia's like, I'm the leader. I'm the guy. Like, he was kind of fed up, and he's like, I'm the guy. And that is an important thing. So were people, I mean, I know Jalen had the title of captain. Were people elbowing each other to be the Michael in the locker room?
No, it was the complete opposite, which was shocking to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you come into the United Center and you see the locker that MJ sat at, it's been vacant since MJ left. And everybody almost treated it as if it was a shrine.
Yeah.
I respected the shrine thing. I was like, look, I get it. But shit, I want some of that to rub off on me. Why isn't last time somebody sat in this locker, we won some damn games. Why wouldn't somebody sit in the locker?
Yeah.
You know? So like that's the way I looked at it.
And you took it.
Yeah. That's damn right I was gonna take it.
Did people give you shit?
I got killed for it. Like it was like all of a sudden like I was
on the team and outside of the
team. I'm sure within the, you know, within the chatter.
Who does he think he is?
Yeah. Always chatter, but you know, like my thing is I'm never going to come out and say I'm great at anything.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't I hold myself internally to that kind of expectation for myself?
Which is like what you did for the season to get through,
I didn't play basketball to be less than Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
I played basketball cuz I wanted to be better than Michael Jordan. I wanted to be better than Isaiah Thomas. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that, those were my original intentions for being sport.
It was that dynamic between, especially Magic on the Dream Team in the Olympics, between Magic and Michael. Like, Magic was sort of kind of moving on to the downside of things, and he was treating Michael sort of holding him down a little bit, and Michael was trying to sort of spread his wings to be the guy in the NBA, and there was that dynamic, and Michael was going for it, and I respected that. You know,
kind of like KD and LeBron.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah, Kyrie, there was that quote from an anonymous quote, like he doesn't want to be the son to, S-O-N, to LeBron, you know? And I get that. And that's on LeBron, too, to know how to manage people. Because basically, you're the CEO of that locker room, if you're LeBron, or if you're, if whoever you are, that's sort of the alpha in that locker room. So it's not just, it's you're one-dimensional if you're just the alpha.
I agree.
You have to know sometimes you gotta sort of use kid gloves to get that guy to work a certain way effectively, whereas you use a hammer on this guy. And I don't expect any of those guys to have that level of a nuance because they're not trained managers. But that's the role they take on when they behave like that.
And here's one of the beautiful things that you learn throughout the process of Duke, and I think it's really been applicable to business for me too. Do you understand how your teammates operate? Do you watch them? Do you study them? Do you see if they're fully committed? How are you building things for them to do that kind of get them more involved? So if you see somebody's passive, how are you handling your time with them off the court to make them more aggressive, especially if you understand they're going to be an imperative part to you winning a championship?
Right.
And I think sometimes with our age now that you're so overwhelmed with all the things that you're trying to do, we have a lot of people that are good at a lot of things, but they're not great at one thing.
Yeah.
You know, and for LeBron, LeBron is the best ever I've seen play the game.
Really?
And I know that drives people crazy, and people want to say, well, you know, how can you say it's better than Michael Jordan? LeBron James is 6'8", 255. If he wanted to score, I don't care what Michael Jordan wanted to do, Michael Jordan could not stop him.
Yeah.
If LeBron really wanted to buckle down defensively and use that body to stop Jordan, could Jordan still score points on him in his prime? Of course, but I think LeBron would win that game. People don't understand how big of a freak he is athletically and how gifted he is.
Yeah. Well, you get a sense of it only as a spectator when he just decides to take the ball from three quarters.
You're not going
to
stop him.
It's just scary. It's like watching NFL games live in the first row and you're seeing these, you know, 275 linebackers, 6'8", just run, like freak,
car accidents,
freak fast, like freak, like bolt fast, like that. And so that's an interesting, I never heard anybody put it that way, but you're right. As I think about it, and sort of, I don't see him stopping him on a consistent basis.
No, and then fans want to minimize it because they say, well, Golden State beat him. I'm like, Golden State has 3-point shooters. Like, guys, you just, like, you ever play rec basketball? Like, I play in all these leagues now, and it's the best kind of basketball you could ever play. Because some teams come down, we have like three or four guys can shoot threes. All we do is sprint up and down the court and shoot threes, and you could score 5 twos in a row. We have 3 threes. We're right there. 1 point behind you. Right. Like, you're running great sets. Doesn't matter. You're the best player in the world. You got guys that get hot from the outside. Yeah. It's a game changer.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's
what
Golden State has.
So after the season, everything's going great, and then you have a motorcycle and you go for a ride and shit hits the fan and you get in a really bad accident.
Literally shit hits the fan.
And I was reading your description of it that, like, you were almost like you popped a wheelie in a way and you should have sort of leaned back or maybe fallen off backwards, but instead your instinct was to force the front of the bike down, and by the time you looked up, you hit a pole.
Well, to go into that you know, many seconds of thought there, you know, the first reaction should have been to let the bike go.
But then I would think, like, shit, my head's going to slam against, I'm going to bust my head up, slamming on the concrete.
See, that's reasonable thinking here, Paul.
Did you have a helmet on?
I did not.
Boy, you are a douchebag. My thing, what the fuck were you thinking?
I own I was a douchebag. You should have seen some of the other douchebag things I was doing that year. But for me, it wasn't about letting go because I was afraid of hitting my head. It was, I wanted to save this damn bike that I had just bought. I don't want to fucking ruin this bike. I spent $9,000 on this damn bike. It was red and black exterior. It's new exhaust. I fucking looked good that day. Even though there was nobody around watching me, I looked good that day. And I think it was overall that mentality that screwed me in the end.
Yeah, well, that's a 20-year-old, 21, 22-year-old kid thinking, right?
Yeah, so you know, by the time I bring the bike down, the bottom wheel had spun out. Next thing you know, you're headed towards fate. And I tried to turn the bike at the last second and eclipsed the entire left side of my body.
So you turned right.
I tried to turn right because I tried to, you know, you see yourself going up on the curb and you see this pole, and like, just get the hell out of the way. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, things happen so fast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Have you ever been in an accident before?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, next thing you know, I end up on the curb and, you know, my chest is up on the grassy knoll area between the sidewalk and the curb as if I'm laying on my stomach, and my legs are on top of each other on the pavement as if I'm laying on my side. And that's when you quickly recognize when it feels like somebody's pouring hot water on your body, but you keep touching your body and you can't feel your body from the legs down and you can't see any blood, that shit is real.
Something's going on inside that's bad.
All these little problems where I came home and it's, I didn't know, my girlfriend yelled at me, or I couldn't score a bucket today, or my mom's having a pissy mood.
I went six for ten at the free throw
line. I've had a shitty day, a bad meeting. What a bad day. I'm like, no, this is fucking a bad day. This is a really bad day right now.
My legs are completely turned around on my body. Why does my foot look sideways?
It's probably not the right placement for it. This is probably a bad day.
Sorry, I don't mean to be laughing.
No, you should be able to laugh at it.
That's a great way of putting it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It just puts things in perspective.
Boy, I don't want to be your kid when you have kids.
Oh, he's going to have it rough.
You think you have it rough?
You're going to pick it up.
My leg, one foot was on one side of the street and one foot was, oh man.
You see your bone sticking out? Just push it back in. It'll mend naturally. That will be me. Yeah.
Oh, God. So you are now, you know, you're in a bad way, right?
Yeah.
And so you...
I recognize shit was real when that happened, but I think things kind of catapulted when I got to the hospital. Because as a boy, I had broken bones growing up.
Yeah.
I was always that kid. I was, you know, did life with reckless abandonment.
Right.
And it was like, hey, you can't jump over that creek. I'm like, I bet you I can.
Yeah.
And I jump and I snap my ankle, right? And you're like, oh, God.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're used to when you're a kid, you break something, you come into the office, there's one doctor there. They might have to reset it or whatever.
Yeah.
And you put yourself in the cast and you're on your way.
Are you in pain as they're putting you, are you feeling any pain as they're putting you into the ambulance and taking you to the hospital?
I'm literally in so much shock that I can't feel the pain.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know how I can really explain it if anybody's ever had pain to that degree, but it's like my body just became numb.
And you're awake.
I called my mother. I left a voicemail for her in New Jersey to come to Chicago because I had been in a really bad accident. And the paramedics told me that they had just thought I'd broken a couple of bones. Now, even though it didn't feel like that, I don't know what the hell I'm feeling anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're wondering, like, are they just telling me this shit to try to keep me calm from being hysterical?
Yeah.
Or is it like, you know, is that really the case? And when I get gurneyed into the hospital and you see this flurry of people running around you,
it's real. This is some real shit.
I just didn't break any fucking bones. Like, this is like something else. Like, that thing that I feel like I'm dripping inside, like I'm bleeding internally, probably.
It's like you see the doctor going, oh, this is gross. I can't hit.
I can't look at it. When a doctor squeezes your hand and looks away, you're like, no, look at me.
Right.
Tell me everything's okay.
The nurses, the doctors are all throwing up. Nobody wants to take care of you. This is too gross for me. I should have been a lawyer.
And my mom, you know, my mom's all into sci-fi, and we joke around with it now. She's like, well, how was it like when they, you know, brought you in? And I'm like, I felt like I was in one of those fucking sci-fi movies, like when I was, you know, brought to this alien spaceship and they put me on this cold metal plate and you see all these people in masks and they're like, just breathe, everything will be okay. I'm like, motherfucker, everything is not going to be okay. Why do you have a scalpel on your hand right now? Like, what's going to happen?
Why has he got a chainsaw? What are you cutting off? Yeah.
And I think for that split, I mean, I know we're joking around, but within that moment, man, you start to have these seconds, milliseconds of reflection where you start to look back on your life, Paul, and you're like, why the fuck did it? You start reevaluating.
Did you start saying stuff, why did I get on the bike?
Yeah, like, not even why I get on the bike. Like, why was I lying to my parents? Why was I trying to be somebody that I really wasn't? Why would I jeopardize everything I worked hard for my entire life. Wait,
lying to your parents like at much earlier in your life about something?
No, or just, I mean, it's about this thing, like, you know, we're 21 years old, and I, you know.
You're reflecting on yourself in terms of the quality of the person you've been overall?
Yeah, I was changing. You know, I watched my dad work long and hard to get me to this place. I watched my mother going back to school, you know, to earn multiple degrees. I had the right foundation in place. And you start, I don't care what anybody says, you know, my parents, my dad made, you know, he barely got right there at six figures, which is great. You know, my mom had worked, you know, 15 years to finally reach principal level, you know, 20 years to finally become a principal. And all of a sudden, within a millisecond, I get drafted and I have several million dollars in the bank. And I know to somebody from the outside, you look at that, like, hey, you have no problems in the world, man. But when I never had money, or when your family never had money, that old school, you know, song by Biggie, you know, more money, more problems, like that, it becomes real.
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, you have family members that never, you know, really want to be around, and start being around.
Yeah.
And start, you have friends that, you know, you're that guy that can help them achieve their dream. So, you know, I said
it before. Hey, I got this idea for a new can opener.
I said it before to anybody that gets drafted or anybody that hits the lottery. You know, that whole concept of I made it, you throw that shit out of the window. No. Your family, look at, no, we made it. We made it. And it takes a certain level.
You see that with the Ball family for sure.
It takes a certain level of maturity. You know, for anybody, you go back to being 21, let me throw you $5 million and let's see how you run with it.
Right.
It's easy to say, oh, I would have done this or I would have done that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You can buy things you never thought of buying before.
Yeah.
You know, and you have some kind of fame.
But at 20, and listen, I give you credit because there's a great, great, great quote here. If I tell you I made peace with this, don't believe me. I love how frank you are in this book. I will never fully be at peace knowing that my fate was for lack of... how do you put it? Talent. and you say, or an erosion of skills. It was as a result of a stupid decision. So did you know consciously or at least subconsciously, I shouldn't be riding a motorcycle? I don't know if it was in your contract that you shouldn't have done
it was.
That. Right. So what is it? Is it just this whole thing of like, I'll jump the creek, I'm sort of invincible? Or you had actually said like you were at a place in your life where up to that point you had constantly told what you can and can't do. So now you had this freedom and you were going to say, well, no, fuck that. I'm going to do what I want to do and exercise my freedom.
All the above. When I wrote that book, I was 30 years old, and I did still look at my accident as stupid. I don't look at it like that right now at 35, and we'll probably get into that a little bit later. But I think they're reasonable means of justification for all my accidents. And, you know, yes, it was in my contract that I'm not allowed to, you know, ride a motorcycle. Is it anybody's contract that you're allowed to drink and drive?
I mean, right.
It's not in your contract, but if you get caught drinking and driving, you have a job, chances are you could lose your job.
Yeah.
So I think there's a whole series of things that everybody can really understand about this.
Yeah.
Whereas, yes, I was jeopardizing certain things because I was just lost in the moment of adrenaline and of excitement.
Mm.
And of also feeling that I finally had my own power. Like I finally felt like I did not need to answer to other people about what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for me at 21 years old, I associated that power with being a man. Oh, this is what being a man is about.
Doing quote unquote manly things.
I have my own money.
Yeah.
You know, I can do what I want when I want it.
Yeah.
I'm taking care of my family.
Mm.
You know, that's what I associated.
Right.
And,
so the thought of it, and also a feeling of invincibility. I mean, you're a great athlete, a physical specimen in great shape. So the thought of you hurting yourself probably didn't even enter your mind. Like, I got this badass looking bike that goes 100 miles an hour, and that's what I feel like doing today, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, have you ever had those scenarios in life where sometimes things are just happening so fast, and then after a couple of days, you're like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
Like, wow. Like, why did I even do that?
Yeah.
And I think for me, I think to say that I was thinking that stuff while it was going on is not true at all. I don't think I was thinking at all.
Yeah.
I think I was just running. I was just going. It was like it was like somebody took me off a leash and it was like, ooh, here I am.
Yeah. And you're right. When you put that amount of money in, and you're still a kid at 21.
Yeah. And, you know, I just started to figure it out on the basketball end.
Yeah.
Now, you know, look, other guys had rode bikes too. I mean, you had seen pictures of Kobe and his motorcycle team, or MJ and his motorcycle team. Yeah. And, you know, our head coach Bill Cartwright went on long rides on his Harley when we went on West Coast trips. So, you know, everybody was pushing the boundaries in different ways.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not going to sit here and tell you there's still not moments where you watch, you know, some of the older guys that are playing and have been in the league for 14 years, and you know, you sit back and you wonder, how would I have been? This would have been my 15th year in the league.
Yeah.
You know, would I, you know, what kind of person would I have been?
Yeah, but I think that, I don't know, do you believe in sort of things happen? My wife does. I'm not so much, but things happen for a reason, or...
Well, I mean, that's the reason why I named the book Life is Not an Accident.
Do you think that is, or is it more that things happen and then we sort of, what you've done, you reinvent yourself, you sort of, you tap into another side of yourself that maybe you didn't know existed.
I just refuse to live my life through the prism of being negative.
And how long did that take you to get? Because I know you talk about you went out on with a cane to talk to some kids at Duke after the accident. Yep. And you were in the context then of like suicidal, and yeah, like you threw it all away. Like, yep. How do you start managing? Once you get through the physical pain and now you're rehabbing and you're doing physical therapy, you just hit a depression and you just completely...
Major. Yeah. Major depression.
And how are you dealing with it? Are you talking to anybody about it? Or are you just popping pills to kind of make the pain go away?
Well, for a while, I was still popping pills. I was prescribed Oxycontin because my nerve had to regenerate, which they equate to childbirth, which is pretty painful.
Yeah.
So I was on that for, you know, 3.5-4 years. And I think some of the steps that I took in order to get to where I'm at today, number one, is I started to recalibrate who the hell I was surrounding myself with. Mm. And, you know, at the time, I was, you know, surrounding myself with people that were moving fast. I had this younger kid that was helping me get my drugs. I meet him at a local bar across the street. I mean, Oxycontin. So
is after the accident.
It's way after the accident. Yeah. This is around 24, 25.
But you also talk about, like, the Bulls were pretty cool. Like, they continued to pay you salary. But then they were, like, teammates and stuff, like, they just never heard from them again, right? There were some people that, like, weren't there for you from your basketball life.
Well, reflecting back on it, I mean, it's always a challenge because you have friends that go through stuff and you try to be there, but inevitably you get caught up with your own life.
Yeah.
It happens. You know, yeah. I was at the Players Tribune party. I got a chance to sit down and talk to Tyson Chandler. And Tyson and I haven't had a sit down conversation since I was 21 years old.
Hmm.
You know, and now me be 35 and I think he's 33.
Hmm.
It's, you know, I sat there and I was like, I don't know why I was angry about you not coming to see. Like, and he's like, I did try to come see you. You're like, wait, you tried to come see me?
Mm.
He's like, I did try to come see you. They just wouldn't let me upstairs. You know, and then I got busy because he has a wife and he has kids and people start. Yeah. And, you know, it all depends on how you choose to reflect upon that.
Yeah.
You know, are you the victim or are you somebody that's walking away from
But that's got to be feeding your sort of depression / anger / bitterness,
that given time,
right?
Yes.
Like, I'm busted up. My friends aren't here. Blah, 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 blah. You're starting to sort of... ease the pain, if you will, with pills or whatever. So how do you see any light at the end of the tunnel at that point? Like,
no, I think I finally started to see some light after I tried to drink myself in a frenzy and take Oxycontin and just try to end it the second time. I was living in the Lower East Side. I was on 13th and First. I lived with three of my roommates, a guy named Hal, one of my best friends named Graham Bunn, one of my other best friends named Joey Aponte.
And why were you in New York City at that point?
I was working for a sports agency. I was trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do because I really couldn't play as much anymore.
Well, you talked about you played for the Austin Toros in the Development League.
Yeah.
But then you hit this, there was this day or week or whatever where you go, yeah, it's not coming back. Talk about that. Talk about what you were trying to do to get back and then the physical therapy and everything else you had to do, but then that sort of emotional realization.
Too much physical therapy, like 3 times a day for 2.5-3 years. That's pretty fucking tiring and arduous. Yeah. And then...
Why were they letting you do so much? Why were
I had to.
Yeah.
What else was I?
You broke. Did you break your pelvis?
I separated my pubic symphysis, which is like when a woman has a baby, it splits by 13 inches. Mm. I dislocated my knee, which means I tore every ligament in my knee.
Mm.
I severed my peroneal nerve, which is a nerve that allows you to pull your foot up to operate your big toe, which I still don't have function to this day. And yeah, I mean, I had a lot of nerve damage. I couldn't get erect for, you know, 2.5-3 years.
That's my problem. I can't get erect.
Hey, man, they make blue pills for that.
I didn't even hit a pole with a motorcycle.
There you go. I cannot get erect.
Boy, that's just like, that's an ultimate slap in the face from God. Like, you fucking, you know, your career's over and you can't even get a decent heart on the fucking girl.
Friends like would take you to strip clubs and stuff, and the girl's like dancing for you, and she's like, I don't do it for you. Like, nope, no, you don't do it for me. You do nothing for me. Next, here we go.
Unless you're a medical genius, exactly. You can't help this problem I have right now.
You're like, oh, you're kind of cute. You're kind of cute. You're not my level, but thanks for the dance, you know?
You do it. You're for the average guy. So I want to get back to the sort of where you are on the Lower East Side, but the Development League time and sort of now you're trying to come back. What is that like to be playing at that level, and then the realization that you can't get there?
Well, it was way different than playing in NBA, playing for the D League or the G League as they refer to it now. You know, taking 14-15 hour bus rides to play back to back. And after the game's over, you get a Dixie cup of ice to rub your knee down with. That's a different experience.
Yeah.
And I think the moment that kind of broke me with it is I tore my hamstring off my bone, and I had to go to the hospital. And
this is separate from the motorcycle accident.
Yeah, we're talking about, I'm like 23, 24. I got let go by the Nets. I was trying to come back. Didn't really work out. Went down, was supposed to go overseas and play over in Italy. Then while working out by myself a week or two before I was about to accept the deal, dislocated my right ankle working out by my fucking self. You can't make this shit up.
Is this the ankle that was broken?
No, I didn't break an ankle. I dislocated my good leg, my right leg. Then went back to North Carolina, did more therapy, then went down to the D League, played for the Austin Toros, played a couple of games, almost had a triple-double. Then I tore my hamstring off my bone on my left leg, had to go back to the hospital. Oh, my coach, Dennis Johnson, who played with the Boston Celtics,
DJ
was my boy. He promised me that I was going to get back into the league.
DJ stole the ball!
There you go, exactly.
Johnny Most.
And we watched tape together. We developed a great relationship. And you know, I had to go back to Durham after that. He told me he would save a spot open for me on the team when I finally got healthy. And that's when I got a call from one of my teammates that just said that, you know, DJ just passed away playing basketball in the court. He had a heart attack.
Oh, shit.
And I think I hit, you know, rock bottom. I was starting to go deep into that space right around that time, and that kind of triggered it. Because before, I was very myopic. Yeah. I was very focused on how the hell do I get back? You know, I'm nothing without basketball. Yeah. Basketball is everything to me.
Yeah.
And I put all my attention and effort on that. And that was the first time I just said, you know what? I have to start distancing myself away from this thing that I've defined.
Because you sort of, you had this one last breath of life and DJ having you come back to the team, then he dies, and it's sort of like that last flicker of flame gets blown out, and you're like, I can't put myself through this. Just for a second, what were your physical limitations? Now, obviously, and I'm not trying to be funny, but like, what couldn't you do after the accident? Obviously, because there were these physical things that kept you from being the player you were. I would imagine mentally, emotionally, you were still there and driven and all of that stuff. But what physically couldn't you do?
Well, my knee would become a balloon each and every day. Ugh. So, I mean, you're still taking Oxycontin. I'm taking ibuprofen 800 probably 3 or 4 times.
Could you not drive as effectively or jump as high?
I still had a great first step.
Yeah.
My upper body got a lot bigger because I wanted to bulldoze through people instead of trying to be a speed demon and just blow by people.
Yeah.
It was the biggest challenge was I had drop foot. So, I mean, think about it. You know, if the ball's in my left hand and I want to beat you going left, you know, and I use my left foot to step first, you have to be able to pull your foot up in order to step. So almost in a way, I had to hike my hip up. So it was almost, it gave it away that I was trying to drive left.
Oh, because going back to what you're talking about, this defender, you watch the belly button, so you see the hip move
exactly.
With you. And you know,
well, think about it. I mean, have you ever tried to walk and not pick your foot up?
All right, hang on.
Now I want to see it. Like, take your right leg and don't pick your, see, you just naturally do it because you've been doing it your whole life.
Right.
Now just try to, now take a step with your left foot, pick your left foot up, and then now don't put your right foot up and walk with your right foot. Don't pick it up.
Wait, just, don't pick what up, my right foot?
So don't flex your right big toe. So when you walk, take a natural step with your right foot. See how you flex your toe, you pull up?
Yeah.
Bring your right foot back.
Right.
Now do not flex your right foot, your right toe. See how you drag it? So now think about that. If you're playing basketball,
you're walking like Frankenstein.
Exactly,
in a
way. Like dragging your foot. Right? So if you have to do a move, there's no way you could do a move and drag. You're going to trip on yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
So they built a shoe where around the toe area of the shoe, there was a strap where I took this metallic elastic band and I pulled it up and I pulled it around my ankle and it kept my foot dorsiflexed. So I would be able to pick my foot up because my foot had to stay up. So all of a sudden I'm walking, it was
so you go one foot is always pointing up in the air a little bit on a 45 degree angle, exactly. Then you could push down
For me to get my clear my gate to try to get by it.
Wow.
But yeah. I was really, really sore.
Yeah.
And think about what that does for you defensively. I mean, defensively, you have to pick your foot up to move.
Yeah.
Going up and down.
Push your knee. Your lateral movement must have really
sucked. Yeah, the little minutiae of the game that you don't pay attention to when you're not injured and you're healthy. You know, all of a sudden that wear and tear just eventually broke me down.
So how do you, so DJ passes away, and now you're kind of coming to the realization, like, this ain't going to happen, this comeback. And this gets back to the beginning of our conversation is with who you are, you know, in the Players Tribune, is like who you are outside of this thing that you've done all your life. And you don't know who you are, plus you're in a haze of sort of drugs, right?
Yep, and depression.
Yeah, and how are you, are your parents talking to you? Are you distancing yourself from anybody close to you? And then how do you work your way through that?
Well, you know, my parents are always there for me. Unfortunately, I think at that given time, a lot of people, all the things they were saying to me became white noise.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, the TV that's on at your house that you keep walking by, you know it's on, you just don't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And I was, after my second attempt where I tried to take a lot of OxyContin and drink a half bottle of Jack, waking up the next morning was one of those moments where I started to really start to think about, okay, you know, how do I even try to redefine myself? Because basketball isn't working out. You know, and the thing that
By the way, just let me ask you. When you do a bottle of OxyContin and half a bottle of
Jack,
what do you feel like the next morning?
Shit. I felt like death.
I've done some weed or whatever, and then I like Jack. That's one of my drinks, and not that much. And I really felt like shit, so I can just imagine. I'm surprised you didn't sleep for like 2 days.
You know, my boy Dre, who's in the next room, always kind of jokes around with me and gives me a fucking breath mint sometimes because I'll go throughout the course of the day and not eat, and you're constantly talking. He's like, bro, you need this. And imagine what my breath smelled like that day, Dre. Jesus Christ. It was beyond horrific. I felt like I was just in this daze, man. I was floating.
But that second time that it didn't work, did that tell you that you really didn't want to die and that it was not to be, that you would die and that you'd kind of figure this out?
People have the power to manipulate their own mind if they choose to do so.
Yeah.
And I think it was the first time that I said, what the fuck am I doing? I'm going down this road that is ultimately going to lead to my death because I do not want to be here.
Yeah.
And it was the first time in my life that I thought about, what do I want my legacy to be? You know, I had always, you know, one of these things too that happens when I was on my way up, I had always said the right thing. Didn't necessarily believe what the fuck I was saying. I was just saying it because it was the right thing to say.
Know, you were savvy enough to know what to say, especially in the media.
Exactly. So you start thinking about all these things I had been talking about. Like I had this tattoo on my left wrist that said believe. To err is human, to forgive is divine. You start looking at all this stuff. Maybe I should start trying to fucking believe in some of this stuff.
Yeah, now you really have to believe.
I have to.
It's life or death kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm not going to sit here and say that all of a sudden at the age of 25, I just figured it out and I had all the principles, of these things. This is how you redefine yourself. I think a lot of those people have a lot of bullshit, man.
Yeah.
I went through very difficult, rough times.
Yeah.
But what I did do is I started having honest conversations with myself. And I try to tell people, even to this day, I still don't have it all figured out. Prime example, you know, going through the stuff with my, you know, ex-girlfriend, you know, where you go through something really bad and you come out of it and you want to blame yourself for certain responsibilities or actions that happened. And you go back and you say, all right, this is who I was at that given moment because this path took me down this road. How do I change it? But being vulnerable enough with yourself to accept who you were.
Did you, in other words, learn how to forgive yourself and understand you're a human being and you're going till the day you die, make mistakes? And
I think I started, Paul, for the first time in my life to treat my life the way I played the game. So the principles that I learned throughout the game of basketball.
Which were
sometimes mistakes happen. I can have three turnovers in a row, But if I take that negative mentality of just turn the ball three times over in a row, I'm not going to be able to do anything successful for the rest of the game if I have that
mentality.
Well,
they say the greats are the ones with short-term memory.
Exactly. So my thing is, that happened. I have to learn from that. And I would be doing myself a major disservice in my life if I did not take a second to learn from my mistakes.
Do you think that you were upset that you weren't going to be able to play basketball just purely as a basketball player, or you weren't going to be a star? Because we live in a star culture and a star fucker culture, and mm-hmm. so you're a multi-million dollar player, you're on your way, you have MJ's locker, you know, you're second picked in the NBA draft. So now you're a star, or on the verge of being a big star. Were you missing that a lot, and was that contributing to your depression?
At that point, like, yeah. I was still getting attention, just it was weird. It was the opposite kind of attention I was used to getting.
Yeah. But you're still in the limelight.
Yeah, but it was more in the limelight, like, oh, you're that guy that fucked up his career. Yeah. In a motorcycle accident. Yeah. That's quite a...
Yeah.
It's, you know, quite a 180.
And that's going to be tough, because people don't let you forget. Like, you try to put it out of your mind.
People say it to me today. I'm like, let's go. People are like, man, like... I really wish you didn't get hurt. I'm like, it's okay, bro. That was 15, 14 years ago. We're good.
Yeah, I've moved on. You should move on.
Exactly. But I think it went through a series of things. I think it was, first off, it was the money. Because you start seeing the amount of money that guys were starting to make.
Right.
And, you know, they're like, well, I could have been, you know, a $100 million player or a $200 million player.
Right.
Then it was the attention, as the attention started to go away. And, you know, it's, you know, our media culture, what have you done for me lately? You know, how are you reinventing yourself? What new things are you getting me to talk about about you, about your accomplishments? And I couldn't do that.
Well, you say, like you said, I hope people remind me of my accident every day of my life, because that means I'm a prime example of somebody who had it and lost it and lost everything and may not have gotten it back, but I did. And so... that's a pretty powerful thing, because I don't know that I'd have the strength to be reminded of this thing every day. That's a pretty special place to get to, and good for you.
Well, I look at the public forum as something that is my therapist.
Oh,
I never got a chance to really go to a therapist, and I wish I would have.
You never went to a therapist?
I did for a short stint, and I have before, but you know,
but
for me,
all those issues. Psychologically, why wouldn't you go like on a regular basis to kind of work through your shit?
Because I was hard-headed and I was stubborn. And once again, I got...
Is it also that the athlete in you, that's kind of like a pussy thing to go see a therapist?
Mental health is a pussy thing. I think I just once again got so caught up in trying to, for a long time, until I kind of wrote the book, and I'm at a way different space in my life than even when I was 30 years old.
Yeah.
I was so busy trying to chase that carrot of what was to prove to other people, hey, I can reinvent myself in a different space, that I don't think I took the time to really reflect. And that was the first time, going through that book was the first time I really started to sit and thoroughly think through all the fucking details of what had occurred.
Yeah.
So for me, using the public forum to be vulnerable and to say, I don't have it all figured out, I'm still in this process of life like anybody else, has been a major release for me.
Yeah. Well, Althea Williams talked about it. It's like, it's when he started to believe that there was more to him than his true love, and that was basketball. He doesn't want to be pigeonholed in his career now. He wants to do many things. He doesn't realize the pigeonholed himself into basketball for all those years. He was so shallow in terms of who he really was, and you had to come out of that and through that to get to the other side, right? Mm-hmm. And how are you different? You've alluded to it a couple of times. You're different now 4 years later from when you wrote the book, because this book it's just mind-blowing in terms of how honest you are about everything, and it's such a great story in terms of, not that it's over, but in terms of how this part of your life, it sort of ended the chapter. Where are you now versus where you were when you wrote the book?
Light years ahead.
In what sense?
I have a lot more depth to me.
Yeah.
And I recognize that there's beauty in the complexity of...
So Althea was right about the shallowness of... Yeah.
What the hell was I talking about as a 21-year-old basketball player?
Yeah.
I mean, every conversation was about me.
Yeah.
And your not that it was done maliciously, but...
No, but listen, I'm if you want to take a broad look at what you did, And what we do now, which is we're in the entertainment business, you're more on the information side as a sports journalist, but you know, you are defined by your credits. Hmm. My credits are what shows I've been on, and Emmy Awards, whatever, and yours are your stat line. So it's not your fault that it's always about you. It's society kind of defines people by labels and shit, which is not healthy, but we have to figure out how to psychologically maneuver that minefield and still be centered in terms of who we are.
That was a great humble brag, really quick too. I didn't know you won a fucking Emmy.
Oh no, I didn't mean to say it that way. I'm sorry. No,
I'm joking with you. I thought there was supposed to be comedy on this show, damn it. Well done. But you know, it's only just defined by your credits. You know, I win an Emmy or two, you know.
I saved a baby from a well.
Well done.
Whatever,
well done. I like that. I'm gonna have to start using
that. Right. I deserve that.
No, but you're absolutely right, man. You know, I think now that I just have more honest conversations. Like, yeah. I really find people fascinating. And, you know, even when, you know, one of my sticklers, I think I'm always going to have this as the athlete mentality, because I don't consider myself by any means to be a fucking athlete anymore.
Yeah.
I think I more so look the part because of my genes. Not that, you know, let me run up and down the court three times and I'm breathing harder than a lot of other people. But I think I just have that mentality to compete where, you know, whenever people intro me, I'm like, oh yeah, thank you. Just feed the fire.
Yeah.
Because I am on College Basketball Game Day, but you know, I have a couple of different shows that are coming out soon. Mm-hmm. You know, my thing is I want to be a young, you know, Black Matt Lauer.
Yeah.
I want to be
I've seen you say that,
that kind of show. Yeah. I want to have real authentic, honest conversations with people. Mm-hmm. I like politics. Mm-hmm. And I'm not afraid to throw my hat in there and swing a little bit.
Yeah.
And I also, I like to recognize, prime example. So the other day, we're talking about LeVar Ball, right? And it was the first time he got thrown out of a game because he didn't like the way the refs were calling the game, and he took his team. They were winning. Yeah. He took his team, and they forfeited the game. He took his team off the court.
And was that the one where he said to the female ref, stay in your lane?
That's the next game that they took off, right? And I kind of just went on air and just said, you know, isn't the foundation, and maybe I might have been romanticizing it a little bit, but isn't the foundation of youth sports to teach our kids that when shit gets rough, you always try to learn how to fight through it?
Yeah.
And what kind of role are you setting for these kids? You just don't like the way a call is and you walk off the court and that's it.
You got to own the responsibility that maybe you're not doing something right in that moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that means you could cheat life, right? So I say that. And then Kevin Durant responds to me. And KD says, come on, Jay, we've all had that crazy coach that does outlandish stuff. And sometimes that's the way the game goes. Now, I have other people that call me and say, oh, you got to go back at Kevin Durant, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, I don't. Like, Kevin Durant has a fair point.
Hmm.
Like, there are two sides to every story. Yeah. And my point, just because I believe it, doesn't make it right. Now, if we go into facts, things that are factual matters, that's one thing. But if it's based upon opinion, I want alternative opinions.
Yeah.
Like, that just enhances my overall intellect about the way you see things.
Yeah.
I think those type of conversations are what I'm fascinated by.
And you talk about politics and your interests. You know that that's not happening in politics. The way we get our news now are these cable news shows with the panels. And the panels are built with, you know, someone on the left and somebody on the right with their agenda and their talking points. And they just want to keep feeding the beast, which is their particular constituency that's either right or left, and they're not really wanting to hear other opinions or the other side of the aisle. And I think that's part of the reason we're so divisive now. So I thought that was great that you kind of said, no, let his opinion sit and my opinion sit, and you decide what you
exactly.
What you
I mean,
believe.
That's the way I get my news now. Like, I'll watch Fox News, and I'll watch CNN or MSNBC, and then walk away.
You gotta watch it all.
Yeah, okay. Like, I agree with certain principles here, and I don't agree with these over here. But let me formulate my own opinion instead of just being, you know, like what I think most Americans do is you get so busy in your life, and then you come home and look, politics or whatever you and your family are going through.
Yeah.
Right. So that's why I try to tell people all the time, like, you know, if you're in the Midwest and you're conservative because your mom and dad have been conservative and that's just the way you see things, and that's the way you are. You know, you're not even going to watch CNN for an alternative perspective on things.
Right.
So, you know, my thing is I'm independent. I want to learn. I want to saturate knowledge.
Well, you kind of, it's like you discover this other person who's been living in your house, the other you, and it's like, man,
where the hell have you been?
And this whole other, like, you've been living in like a one-room studio apartment that is basketball, and you realize, well, I got a mansion. I got all these other rooms I can explore. And And that analogy is why I have an Emmy. No. But what was the moment, just to go back for a second, where you go, okay, the light goes off and I think I found what I'm supposed to do next, which is, you know, broadcasting, communicating. What was, you know, you kind of get yourself sort of out of that haze of the drugs and in a depression, I guess. Was there a moment where it seemed, okay, I think this is...
Yeah, I think finding that second career helped, even though I think throughout the course of finding it, I learned my lesson from the first career I had, that I'm not going to let this career define me, even though I'm passionate about what
That's
I do in it.
That's so hard to not have your career define you.
I agree, but I asked that question today because... to a lot of people out there, unfortunately, you know, when you meet somebody for the first time, like, what's the typical question we ask people? Hey, what do you do?
Right.
And people naturally go into displaying their credits. And yeah. It's funny, they display aesthetic, beautiful credits. Mm. Like, they give you, it's like almost in a way, when you have that conversation with somebody, you're getting their Instagram feed or their Twitter feed.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
You're getting the best parts
of
them.
Yeah.
You know, so for me,
it's
sometimes,
like when people are douchebags and mention they have an Emmy. I know what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, those people are just like the one in the room. I'm talking right now. So.
No, you're right, though. That is. Like, I have friends that'll say to me, and they're dear friends, like, so what projects are you working on now? Or, you know, You're due for your own show. How's that looking? And I'm like, I don't really want to have this conversation. I just want to, you know, be happy in my place where I am right now, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I like to throw people curveballs, you know? It's like, hey, so, you know, what do you do? I'm like, well, my penis didn't work for 4 years. See what they say. You see where the conversation goes. You know, are they going to stare down or are they going to keep me looking in the eyes?
I just looked at
you. Just looked down.
Twice.
See? You saw I was well endowed. I mean, these things happen.
Well, it's actually bigger than when you walked in here, so I don't know what effect I'm having on you. But.
Well, see, like, so that's my thing. It's like, we're all complex individuals, man. Yeah. And I find that I get a lot of things out of humor and just enjoying the process.
Yeah.
You have to enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you, man, I could talk to you forever. By the way, how do you fix your penis not working after 4 years? Do
they penis pumps, they really work. I should get an endorsement with one.
Do you use them?
You pump 3 times a day.
No, you don't.
Your face, though, right now, the fact that you stared at me with that level of concern, you're like, really?
Well, you did, your forearms are pretty big.
What brand do you use?
Either you're whacking off or pumping your penis. I don't know what it is.
No, man, actually.
Hi, I'm Jay Williams. You have a dick that hasn't worked in 4 years? I got the answer for you.
There you go.
It's a Jay Williams penis pump.
Actually, Viagra, I had to take it every single day for 2.5 years.
But what does that fuck up your heart, taking it that much?
I mean, I'm sure there are repercussions of it.
Right.
But, you know, for me, you had to pump blood in that area.
Yeah.
It's not really going there when I wanted to go there. So,
well, we'll take a picture and we'll post it along with the interview when
it's like, you know, it's like that little kid that keeps getting bigger. You just keep posting their sizes on the side of the wall. You know, I'm like, oh, look, he grew to 13 inches today. This guy's getting good.
That's awesome, man. Well, the book is quite a read in terms of just your life and just how honest you are. So what do you think at the end of this next part of your life your memoir would be for this part of your life?
I think right now is how to take that next step for people.
Mm. Coming off of a setback or
I think one of the beautiful things
a right turn in your life.
Yeah, I realized about what I went through is when you start finally getting outside of your own shit and start talking to everybody, like, everybody's been in their own accident in some form or fashion. Some people it may not have been as extreme as my motorcycle accident.
Yeah.
Or some people it may have been worse.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you pick up the pieces from that and move forward?
Mm.
And that's where I get into this whole big thing about, you know, and sometimes it might annoy people. You know, I go to this place right down, I live in Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn, and go to this coffee shop. And this guy, my girlfriend went in there one time, and the guy was talking to my girlfriend, probably trying to hit on her, which he should. And he was like, is your boyfriend like some kind of like motivational speaker? Like, this guy's always fucking happy every time he comes in here. And it's like, you know, I just randomly, I talk to people because I found I am kind of a control freak.
Yeah.
Right. And for a long time, I just wanted to control my actions on the basketball court and I wanted to control my life. And I realized that the only thing I actually have control of is my perspective, my outlook.
Man, I'm not there. I wish I could get there. That and looking back, and I tend to look back. My wife tries to get me to do less of it, but I tend to go, oh, I should have done this. I could have done that. Why didn't I do that at that time?
But see, I feel struggle like, Paul, that when you do that, though, you just hold yourself captive to your past.
Right, and you're not moving yourself forward. And you're really, it's. And I know intellectually, like, you know, if you want to be four steps ahead from where you are, don't be looking at the two steps behind you, because that just kept you from being even one step ahead. I know that, but it's hard for me sometimes. I'm better at it, but I'm not there yet.
Well, it's easy. It's like there's a wall, and if you take three steps over, there's a hallway, and you keep walking into the wall, And then someone says, stop, dude, just fucking take three steps over and walk straight.
Right.
And you're like, holy shit, that's all I had to do?
Yeah,
that's essentially what you do when you look in your past. You're just bouncing back in that same spot. Yeah. You're walking into that wall.
Yeah.
And so my thing is, yes, You know, you have to learn from it. Maybe you might not extract every piece of information to say, I'm this storyteller now, and right. I've can write a book on all my mistakes. But at least you're trying to forge forward.
Yeah.
At least you're trying. You're keeping yourself present in those current moments.
Yeah. And you know what? You're having, not to minimize what you were doing or what basketball players or professional athletes do, but I think that they give sort of instant satisfaction, gratification. If I'm a Bulls fan and you win a championship, it's like I remember that moment, whatever. But you're sort of doing something now in terms of your story and your honesty about it and the redemption and sort of how you bounce back and reinvent yourself, which is it cuts much deeper for people and does more for people than maybe you getting a triple-double four nights in a row for the Bulls. Not to minimize that, but... So no, you know, maybe there's a lot of good that comes from this at a deeper level for a lot of people beyond just yourself.
Here may be your soundbite. If I were remembered for getting triple doubles, that would have been the worst kind of legacy I could have ever left for myself.
Wow. Well,
and I may have made a lot of money.
Yeah.
I may have, you know, who knows what would have happened with my career if I would have went down as one of the best. Who knows? But that would have been so underwhelming for me.
Compared to what you feel your mission is now and everything else.
Yeah,
because
when I talk to people, Paul, it's amazing how people came and talk about themselves because they don't know what the fuck is even going on.
Well, people don't realize who they are for a long, long time.
Yeah, you know,
I do stand-up, and that's a big thing. Like, at some point, you start out, you just don't want to bomb. You're scared to death. You get technique down. But at some point, you have to look in the mirror and go, well, who am I as a comic, and how am I defining myself, and what do I want to talk about? And that forces a lot of introspection, which can, you know, be good for you in your personal life, not just your career, you know?
And it's like little things, too, where you're able to have fun of it. You know, like, I still sit down when I have to take a piss now, and I laugh at myself, because for 2.5 years, I couldn't stand, because it would hurt.
Are you serious?
And I sit down. Now I get lazy. I just sit down.
Sit down all the time.
It's so comfortable.
I swear to God, women
love it.
Come here, I'm high-fiving you on the
right
fucking...
There.
Because I started talking about this in my act. I sit and piss all the time. I'm like, why the fuck would I stand? It's so relaxing.
Yeah, exactly. Sit down, read an article, swipe through some articles, go on Twitter.
Oh, my dick works fine and I still do it.
See? So it's like little things like that where you just... It's, once again, understanding why you do things, laughing at yourself.
Yeah.
Like, life is, I'm not going to say life is not serious, because that would be very cliche, because I think there are moments in life that are very serious. But the one thing that I have learned how to do is that sometimes, man, it's got to enjoy the fucking ride.
Meaning it's not as heavy as we make it out to be. It's not as life or death as we make it out to be.
Yeah, like I'm rushing here to get here, and I get here, I'm waiting for my friend to get here, and I'm trying to write down notes because we do business together. I'm like, this is what I want to discuss with them. This is how I'm going to try to push them today. And next thing I know, I'm in Tracy Morgan's trailer, and I'm talking to him, and he's like, fucking Jay, come on, man. We're out of town. We're out having a 40.
I'm going to get you pregnant.
And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, this is... fucking amazing. Like, this is spontaneous and just...
How great is my life? This doesn't happen to just everybody.
Blessings.
But listen, the book is Life is Not an Accident, a memoir of reinvention. You can get that anywhere that sells books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get the Jay Williams Penis Pump only on Amazon,
only
I think.
On Amazon, yeah.
Right.
$2.99. Right. We're giving off discounts.
They're in light blue, they're in black, and camouflage. I would recommend the camouflage.
We only have one size, XXX.
It's going to be way too big for me then.
It's all right. You got to have somewhere to shoot. What? I didn't mean it like that. It's small. All right, yeah, let's take that.
Nice. Hey, it's great to see you again after all the time, you know, since we worked together. And I'm occasionally doing stuff for ESPN and going on Sports Nation and stuff, so maybe we'll cross paths and do something together at ESPN.
I look forward to it, man. Yeah, I hope that works out.
This was great, man. This could have talked to you all day, so appreciate you being on.
Thanks for having me, brother.
All right.
Okay, that was Jay Williams. How crazy and ultimately, I think, positive is that story? And I'm just amazed at how honest he is about the whole thing. And and he's also a friend, and I couldn't be happier for him. And he's a great analyst on ESPN. He really knows what he's talking about. So thanks for checking out the podcast. Please, please send some links around if you don't mind, and give us a review on iTunes if you haven't. Thanks for checking things out here, and I will see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.